On Saturday night in the AFC wildcard, the Pats favored by 5 points at home according to my friends at Fox Bet. Chris Canny, what do the Patriots have to do to avoid being upset by the Tennessee Titans?
They got to be able to stop the run. And Derrick Henry has been a battering ram, especially the second half of the season. You brought it up in our pre-show meeting about how he's played since that game against the Kansas City Chiefs.
Last six games, 150 yards per game, 10 touchdowns, 6.5 yards per carry. If all he played was the last six games, he would have been one of the 12 best running backs statistically in football.
Yeah, and he just rang up 200 yards in his regular season finale on his way to winning the rushing title. So if you're the New England Patriots, you got to shore up that run defense. And that's been the one area that this team has been a little suspect on. We always talk about how good the Patriots are on the back end with their secondary, but we don't talk about the interior of their defense, and that's exactly where the Tennessee Titans want to bludgeon you on offense. There's a reason why Ryan Tannehill led the league in passer rating, and there's a reason why he led the league in yards per attempt. It's because he's getting a lot of chunk play opportunities in the play-action passing game because teams are selling out to stop the run. So if you're the New England Patriots, you absolutely have to slow down Derrick Henry. You can't let him average 5-plus yards a carry. Otherwise, you're going to set up opportunities for Ryan Tannehill and A.J. Brown to get some big plays in the passing game. And we've already seen that Patriots offense is not an explosive offense. If you let this Titans team get up on you early, that could spell big trouble for the Pats.
Yeah, they definitely have to stop the run. Obviously, Derrick Henry and not making those business decisions on the back end, which you saw a lot of teams at the end of the season were saying, I don't want to tackle 6'4", 250.
Especially at the end of games.
Yeah, at the end of the games, they were saying, I don't want to do that. I would add to the Patriots' success, they have to be able to run the football. Just imagine what you saw last year from guys like Sony Michel in the playoffs. Against the Chargers, first round, 24 carries, 129 yards, 3 touchdowns. Against the Kansas City Chiefs, 29 carries, 113 yards, 2 touchdowns. And then in the championship game, 18 carries, 94 yards, and a touchdown. You have to be able to run the football in the postseason and stop the run if you want to be successful, especially if you're not getting the chunk plays down the field from Tom Brady and Philip Dorsett or N'Keal Harry. You have to be able to run the football. If they can do that, they got a chance to keep going and not be upset by the Tennessee Titans.
Your point on Sony Michel is a great one. After the spectacular playoff run, I think a lot of people expected him to be the centerpiece of the Patriots offense this year, and he responded by not having a single 100-yard game all season, struggling mightily. Maybe it's the offensive line turnover. Maybe it's James Devlin not being there. Whatever it is, he has not been the player in year two he was in year one. And Nick Chubb, who we were talking about earlier with the Browns, his teammate at Georgia, a lot of people thought Chubb should have been the pick for the Patriots in that spot. They pass on Chubb, they take Sony Michel. All Nick Chubb did was finish second in the league in rushing, second only to Derrick Henry. But I look at this game a little bit differently. You guys are talking about the Patriots stopping the run, the Patriots running the football. If Tom Brady doesn't turn the ball over, they'll win. The last game they lost where Brady played a clean game was the Miami game last year that involved 7 laterals at the end of the game to beat them. Every game they have lost this year has included a critical Brady mistake, and I think it's gotten to the point with Belichick after the pick six against Miami where he has lost some faith in Brady as far as one thing this year Brady has done at an elite level is not turn the ball over, is not make the critical mistake. Trust, he has said it on countless interviews, he being Brady, we're a defense and special teams oriented team, it's our job to take care of the football. Yet in their 4 losses, he has 4 interceptions, all of which either while the Pats had a lead they were trying to extend or in the midst of a possible Patriots comeback that gets stifled by a Tom Brady pick. So I think if he plays a clean game, as good as Tannehill's been this year, and Tannehill led the league in passer rating, led the league in yards per attempt. It's not like he only played 6 games, played 12 games. He was sensational. And as good as Derrick Henry was this season, I don't think the Titans can go to Gillette and win a game where the turnover battle's even. Certainly, if they lose the turnover battle, they are sunk. But if the Pats just play them even, I feel like you know the Patriots are going to have a special teams edge, not as far as making field goals, but as far as either blocking punts, returning kicks, doing something in that regard. And the home field advantage there is so enormous. To me, the question is, can Brady play a clean game? Because if he doesn't, then the Titans can start doing what they love, which is dare you to sell out against Derrick Henry. And they got two wide receivers that can hurt you now. A.J. Brown has been sensational as a rookie, and Corey Davis had a bit of a down year. The last time Corey Davis played the Patriots, he hit him for 7 and 125 and a touchdown, lighting up Stephon Gilmore. Now, I don't know who Stephon Gilmore is going to be on. Either way, it's going to be a tough cover. So I'm very curious to see what the Patriots' offensive game plan is, if they trust Brady to drop him back 40 times, or if they say, play a clean game and we think our defense can handle an all of a sudden potent Titans offense.
Well, I think you have to trust the identity of what your team has been the entire year, which is defense and special teams. That's where the Pats are at. You know where the Titans are at. They want it to be that run game, yep, with Derrick Henry and that offensive line. Now, the way that you can get at the Titans offensively is if you put them in long downs and distances, because they've given up the second most sacks in the National Football League. I think they've given up 56 sacks on the season. So if you can get them in that type of game, then obviously it would be advantage Patriots. But you also have to recognize that the Titans are undefeated when Derrick Henry rushes for over 100 yards. So that to me is where it starts for the Patriots. That's your path to victory. I have a hard time believing that we're going to see a completely clean football game, because both defenses are top 10 in takeaways. So you know that somebody is going to force some turnovers. If you're the Patriots, you recognize how important that is to your success, being able to create some extra possessions, short fields for your offense, a unit that has struggled to move the ball consistently all year long. It's also a unit that struggles in situational football on third downs and in red zone. So if you're that Pats defense, you want to try to have this keep away mentality with the Titans offense. Allow your offense to have as many possessions as they can and put them in as many situations as you can. Give them opportunities to score points.
One of the things that every time I think of playing the Patriots, you think of the mystique. You think of going into Gillette. You think of Tom Brady across the field and Bill Belichick. One of the things that I don't think the Titans are going to be worried about is that mystique. Mike Vrabel, he was there for a long time. He understands who Bill Belichick is. He understands the culture there in New England. And I think the teams that have beat New England this year, Kansas City, the Ravens, they went there and they weren't scared. They weren't afraid. They weren't saying, hey, we're going to bow down to the Patriots and kiss the rings. They didn't say any of that. And I think this Tennessee Titan football team is going to be the same exact way. They're going to go in there and they're going to get after it. They have one of the most aggressive and nasty coaches I played against in football. And when you think about this thing, this is what they have to do. They have to get the run game going. But Ryan Tannehill has to be the guy that he's been since replacing Marcus Mariota. He's been the guy that's been first in passing. He's been first in yards per attempt and first in completions all season long since he's played. If he can get that, if we can get that out of Ryan Tannehill, then the Titans can win this football game in Gillette.
The Vrabel angle is a really interesting one, because I think people think of Vrabel like, oh, he was one of Belichick's assistants. He never was. He was with the New England Patriots. He wanted a new contract after the 2008 season. Not only would they not give it to him, they threw him in the Matt Castle trade to Kansas City. Helping him win 3 Super Bowls, helping him have the undefeated season, they traded him away to a place he didn't really have much interest in going, in Kansas City. And then where did he get his coaching start in the NFL? It was not with Bill Belichick. It was with Bill O'Brien, who obviously was part of the Belichick's tree. Vrabel made the point. He said, I haven't collected a paycheck from New England in over 10 years, since 2008. So not that he wouldn't be at maximum motivation for a playoff game, but there's just a little extra, I think, with this, that Belichick, it did not, nurture him along the way he maybe did Brian Flores, the way he maybe did Bill O'Brien. Vrabel's had to go do this on his own, and now he has a chance, I'm sure he feels, to put the nail in this dynastic coffin. So we will see that this weekend.
The Associated Press came out with their Athletes of the Decade, and LeBron James edged out Tom Brady for the honors this decade. Brady went to 5 Super Bowls, won 3. LeBron went to 8 NBA Finals, won 3. Brian, you think they made the right call here? Is LeBron the male athlete of the decade over Tom Brady?
I mean, yeah, I think you're kind of splitting hairs between these two. You're talking about the best athletes that we've seen in a very long time, not just this decade. But I would pick Tom Brady for this reason. Football is just a team sport. And Tom Brady has done it with so many different people, a different offensive line unit, different wide receivers, different defenses. And he's done it against different teams as well. LeBron and basketball, think about this. LeBron can be dominant and win a bunch of games. He did it in Cleveland at the beginning of his career, made playoffs, made finals without any help because he was that good. Tom Brady, you're seeing it this year, he has to be good, but everyone else around them has to be good as well. That's why I would lean towards Tom Brady. But, I mean, you can't have a wrong answer here.
For the exact reason you made, however, is the reason why I think it's so clearly LeBron, because you're absolutely right. Brady can win a Super Bowl like he did last year, where he wasn't very good in that football game, where they score 13 points. If LeBron isn't good, his team loses. Those are the rules of engagement. They have been the entirety of his career. No matter how good his teammates have been, he's never had a championship where you're like, oh, his teammates carried him to that. Go ahead,
no,
Brian.
Well, Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh carried LeBron a few times.
Well, they were, but he was the best. Every championship they won, he was the best player.
No doubt about it.
He certainly has had help. I'm not arguing that when he's won titles, he hasn't had help. But there's never been a moment where you said, wow, the Cavs or the Heat or whomever won the title, won that series, despite LeBron James. But the numbers also, the Associated Press, who has gotten this, the athlete of the year, wrong a number of times, they maybe should scrub their history a bit. Jackie Robinson did not win it the year he broke the color barrier. College football player did. They've had a lot of odd snubs. This one they got right. The titles they're even on. This decade, three apiece. Finals appearances or Super Bowl appearances, it's 8-5. League MVPs this decade, it's 3-2. Finals MVPs, it's 3-2. And the other element of this that I think factors into it at least a bit is the impact LeBron, and some people would say for bad, I would argue for good. The impact LeBron has had on the sport as far as, and maybe all sports, player empowerment and player freedom of movement, that started this decade. That started with the decision which changed the way we look at what athletes are allowed to do. What athletes are allowed, the superstar athletes leaving where they were drafted to, aside from Kareem, or I guess Lou Alcindor at the time, leaving the Bucks to go to the Lakers, and Barkley leaving Philly to go to the Suns later in his career, it's just something that was not even considered a possibility. And now you see it even in football. You see guys saying, I do not like it here. I want to go somewhere else. And the power dynamic shifting from the organization in the front offices to the players. And that is a direct impact of what a lot of people consider to be LeBron's biggest mistake of the decade, which is the decision almost a decade ago.
LeBron is so special. So, I mean, it's hard to go against him. I kind of still factor in where Tom Brady was drafted at. I know it had nothing to do with this decade, sure. But when LeBron was coming out of high school, he probably was the best athlete in the NBA already at that point. Coming from the sixth round to be this multiple-time champion, Tom Brady, that still means something to me, even though it wasn't in this decade.
And let me make one quick case for Brady, even though I think they got this right. If Brady's career started this decade, he is a first ballot Hall of Famer and one of the 10 greatest quarterbacks ever. If the first decade of his career was his entire career, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer and one of the 10 greatest quarterbacks ever. First decade of his career, you're at three championships, a fourth appearance, a league MVP, an undefeated season. Second decade of his career, this decade, three championships, five appearances, two league MVPs, and a continual reinvention where we didn't see a single downtick really until the end of last year and obviously this season. He and Jerry Rice are the only two NFL players that I feel like you can confidently say had two separate Hall of Fame careers. Bisect their careers in the middle. They are both not only Hall of Famers, they're both all-time Hall of Famers of what they did. That is a testament in a brutal sport to what Brady's accomplished. But he's not, I mean, he wasn't the decade over LeBron. I mean, who are we kidding here?
Despite missing the playoffs, Dak Prescott played a terrific game yesterday to close out the season. 303 passing yards, four touchdowns, and a win over Washington in what was the final game for him under his rookie contract. After the game, Dak was peppered with questions about his future and said he wasn't worried about a deal getting done.
Never thought about the contract this season and hadn't thought about it. And I have a great team of people that will handle that. When those talks come and when that happens, it happens. It'll be a blessing, but that's not why I play this game. I play this game for the love of it. My first love is an individual, and I'm committed to those guys in the locker room, my teammates. And that's what wakes me up every day. That's what gets me going. And that's why I play this game, and I play it with a passion and put so much into it. It has nothing to do with a contract or money. So not thinking of that.
All right, Nick, did Dak Prescott prove that he is worth a big money contract this offseason?
No. He's going to get it. And this is just, people say it's the cost of doing business. It's the way it works in the NFL. You have to pay these. No, you don't. You do not have to. Dallas, you do not, no matter what anybody tells you, you are not obligated. It is not, is subclause 6B of the CBA, thou shalt must give Dak Prescott $145 million with $120 million guaranteed. You're allowed to tell this young man, who, by the way, conducts himself beautifully. I wish I had 10% of the maturity at Dak's age that he, hell, I wish I had 50% of it now that Dak has, even though he's 10 years younger than me. He conducts himself flawlessly. He has been a wonderful face of the franchise. He has been, in a league where you don't always get this, a really stellar citizen and leader. And I won't take anything away from him. But it's business. And you're allowed to say to Dak Prescott, here's our offer. We're going to offer you 5 years, $125 million. That's $25 million a year. And we will guarantee $75 million of it. You will never have to worry about money again. You will be set forever. We can continue on the track we're on. And if you want something substantially more than that, we're going to pull this back, and you're going to play for 1 year, $26 million on the franchise tag, and we're going to start looking around. And you can mix metaphors, check Dak's oil, so to speak, as you would say. Like, see how he really feels about playing another prove-it year after he played this prove-it year. Because nobody said when Seattle gave Russell Wilson his $35 million a year, don't know if they should do it because we know he's great. Nobody said it about Aaron Rodgers because we know he's great. I don't think even many people said it about Carson Wentz, even though he wasn't fully proven. The guys who we question it when they get it are the guys who you know shouldn't get it. Goff, we questioned it. Stafford, we questioned it. Matt Ryan, I think some people, even though he'd been to a Super Bowl, you questioned it. Guys that when they get the deal, you're like, it's a lot of money. Your first reaction is the right reaction. It is a lot of money, and it does handcuff your team. So I wouldn't do it. I don't think he earned it this year. I think he played great against bad teams and bad against good teams. I think they will do it, Canty, and I think they'll regret it.
Well, Jenna, you said it coming into this year. Did he earn the right to get paid that kind of money, $35 million a year? No, he didn't. That's the short answer to your question. You talked about Carson Wentz, Nick. We saw that from Carson Wentz this season, being down all three starting receivers, no Aguilar, no Jackson, no Alshon Jeffrey. He was able to find a way to win games. That's what good quarterbacks do. That's why you pay those guys $30-plus million a year, because they're able to overcome all the deficiencies that your team might have and still put you in positions to compete. This thing couldn't have been set up any better for Dak Prescott coming into this year. This was all out in front of him. Arguably the best offensive line in football. Arguably the best running back in football. A true number one wide receiver in Amari Cooper. An emerging number two in Michael Gallup. What else did you need if you were Dak Prescott?
Healthy offensive line throughout the year.
In order to have success, it just didn't make sense. And so when you see some of the losses that this Dallas Cowboys team had, yeah, I'm not paying Dak Prescott market value for a quarterback. Now, I think the Dallas Cowboys will be forced to because they don't have any alternatives this offseason, and you got to make sure you get the return on the investment with the contracts that you've already doled out to players. You're trying to compete for a championship now. You don't have the time to break in a young quarterback. So I think that Dak Prescott is going to be the starting quarterback for the Cowboys, but I don't have confidence that they're going to get a long-term deal worked out just because these two sides are so far away in terms of the compensation. And I actually understand why the Dallas Cowboys have been hesitant to this point to pay him what he's asking for.
And I think they will get a deal done because I'm going to use an awkward metaphor here for a moment. And none of us at this table have ever been divorced, and God willing, none of us ever will be. But if you ever know someone who is on their second marriage, especially if when they got divorced the first time, friends and family were like, are you sure? You sure? Like, are you sure you want to leave your wife of however long, your husband for however long? No. Absolutely. On that second time around, even if they realize early on, this might not be right, they can't have been wrong about the first decision. Jerry Jones, I would wager all the money I have, still wakes up at night saying, Did I move on from Tony too early? Tony was my adopted son. Tony was my guy. We found, we developed, undrafted. I knew he could be it. And I'm seeing, prior to this year, Brady playing to his early 40s. Breeze playing to his late 30s. Until this year, Phillip Rivers played at a high level. And I moved on from him because the new, hot, young quarterback was available to me. If I move on from Dak, then I was wrong about moving on from Tony. But the numbers say, you could say, oh, he was second in the NFL in passing yards. Yeah, the top five in that category are Matt Ryan, Phillip Rivers, Jared Goff, Dak Prescott, and Jameis Winston. They all have one thing in common. Ain't none of them playing in a playoff game this year. Mm. What I care about with Dak is, how was he against good teams? How was he against everybody else? And we can show it to you quickly, I think. Against good teams, Dak Prescott was awful. And the team was awful. Against bad teams, he dominated. Maybe no quarterback in the league you have against Washington. And you saw it yesterday. You got to beat some of the good teams in order to justify the two other Pro Bowl level players you won't be signing because you're giving your quarterback $35 million a year. And I don't see Dak Prescott taking that next step in his evolution.
No, you're right. I don't see it either. And that one win that he has against playoff teams, that came against the Philadelphia Eagles when they were struggling to find themselves. So, I mean, the fact is that this Dallas Cowboys team only beat one club that was over 500 when they played them, that being the Los Angeles Rams. But they still weren't in position to be able to accomplish the ultimate goal, which is competing for a championship, because they lost to the Philadelphia Eagles the following week. So, I mean, when you look at reasons to pay a guy or reasons not to pay a guy, I feel like Dak Prescott gave you more reasons not to pay him this year than reasons to pay him.
Well, you got to ask yourself, how much of this season was on Dak Prescott and how much of it was on Jason Garrett?
To the top story of the morning, that the Cowboys have reportedly moved on from Jason Garrett. There's obviously a ton of speculation about who could be the next head coach in Dallas. According to our guys at Fox Bet, Patriots offensive coordinator Josh McDaniels is the betting favorite to land the job. Brian Westbrook, I ask you, who should be the next head coach of the Dallas Cowboys?
There's a couple characteristics that you need. First of all, you need to be able to develop quarterbacks, because Dak went through a major change from last year to this year. He got better at reading defenses. He understood where the ball should go, and he was a more accurate quarterback throughout most of the season. So you have to continue that maturation for Dak. So you need to be able to develop a quarterback. Also, probably more important than what you do with Dak, you have to be able to push back on Jerry just a little bit and say, Jerry, I understand this is your team and you want to run things one way. However, allow me to be the head coach. Allow me to be the face of the franchise in a way so that after games, I'm speaking and I'm developing and delivering the message to the media, so that there's never a situation that the players are saying, hey, well, we have a head coach, but I can just go to the owner and figure things out a different way. And that's going to be the biggest problem. And so when you look at all those things, it has to be someone that's been in the league for some time. This has some type of credibility. I think Josh McDaniels certainly could be a guy. I love Matt Rhule, even though he hasn't been in the NFL for an extended period. But every place that he's gone, the guys have gotten better. He has taken a losing program in Temple, made them better. Same thing with Baylor, made them better. He's made the guys believe in him. So I can see them going a lot of different ways. But if that guy doesn't have the ability to develop quarterbacks and push back on Jerry, it's another fail as far as a head coach in Dallas.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You got to have a strong personality as your head coach. You have to have somebody that has the confidence and the conviction in what they're doing, so they can push back against Jerry Jones when he brings up ideas that don't make sense in terms of doing what's in the best interest of the football team. Now, I don't want to knock Matt Rhule or Lincoln Riley or any of these other prospective head coaching candidates from the college ranks, but where the Dallas Cowboys are at in terms of winning, they're in their window right now to compete for a championship. I don't think you have time to hire a head coach that doesn't understand what it takes from the head coaching role in the NFL in order to be able to win at the highest level. So that's why I would lean towards somebody like a Josh McDaniels. I mean, I know Mike McCarthy's not in consideration for the job, but somebody along those lines that's actually done it before, because that person has that working knowledge, that person understands what it means to be able to build the structure where you can have sustained success and put guys in position where they do what they do best and keep them out of positions where they get exposed with their deficiencies. So that's why I like the idea of Josh McDaniels coming back as a head coach. You know, in life, you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. And so that two-year stint that he had in Denver, I think him having the opportunity to go back to New England and be the offensive coordinator and try to figure out where he went wrong in his first time around as a head coach, it's probably going to do him some good in his next opportunity as a head coach. And I think that should be in Dallas this offseason.
I think Josh McDaniels would be a home run. I don't love how he left Indianapolis at the altar. I think it was unprofessional. I don't think that's how you do business. The whole league, though, seems to have gotten over it, so I should get over it as well. Everyone wants to interview him. Nobody seems to care about that. They assume his word will be better this time around than it was last time around. And while he failed in Denver, I actually don't really care about that. If we were ranking head coaches in the league, three of them were on their second job. Pete Carroll's on his second job. Bill Belichick's on his second job. Andy Reid's on his second job. Andy Reid's the only one who you would say didn't fail at his first stop. Andy Reid, just after a decade plus in Philly, it was time to move on, but no one would say that was a fit. But Pete Carroll was not successful his time in New England. Went to college, learned from his mistakes, learned how more to be a head coach. Bill Belichick was not successful his first time in Cleveland. Now, you, Coach Mangini, can tell us they were on the precipice, they were on the cusp, but that was not a, nobody looked at Belichick as that was a successful time as a head coach. He learned from it and now became the greatest head coach we've ever seen. The only person I would consider without head coaching experience in the NFL is Urban Meyer. And that's not because Urban's a friend of the show and Urban works with Fox. It's because Urban's track record of success is unimpeachable. He took Utah to a BCS bowl. He took Bowling Green to high level. Utah to a BCS bowl game. National championships, plural, at Florida. National championship at Ohio State. Undefeated 1 year at Ohio State when they weren't even eligible to go to the college football championship. So Urban, I think, has enough cachet that he, similar to Pete Carroll, by the way, when he walked into Seattle. Those USC teams were so successful and had so many pros. You had guys who were already pros who could ask teammates or friends across the league, what type of coach is this person?
Similar to what happened with Jimmy Johnson coming from the to Dallas.
University of Miami, absolutely right. And that obviously was wildly successful for them there. The other element of this, and the reason why I wouldn't do the Matt Rhule, Lincoln Riley thing with the Cowboys, but might do it for the Giants, might do it if Washington hadn't just hired Ron Rivera, for instance, is, or Carolina, if they're interested. If you're rebuilding, I think having a young coach kind of learn on the job is okay. I think that the Giants, Carolina, they know we're not competing. No matter what Dave Gettleman tries to tell you, we're not competing for a championship this year. So if you have some moments where like, okay, I need to do that better, so be it. The Cowboys are in win now mode. I want to ask you this before we wrap up, Brian. If when you were playing, because you were on some damn good Eagles teams, you guys thought we had a Super Bowl opportunity, and all of a sudden you have a coach who you feel like is either in-game decision-making, doesn't quite know how to run a locker room. How do you think the veterans in the locker room respond to that if he's a young guy out of college who hasn't proven himself in the league?
Yeah, I think it would be a problem, especially if this is my last couple years of being able to win Super Bowls or win games in the NFL. There will probably be an issue. But this is how you overcome that. If you're a young coach, if you're Matt Rhule or even Lincoln Riley coming into a situation like the Cowboys, you go get some veteran coaches, guys that have been in the league before to help you advise this football team. That gives you instant credibility with the guys on the team. You find some old coaches, the guys that have been coaches in the NFL already, put them on your staff. They're going to help lead you in that way. I kind of want to go back to Josh McDaniels because it's starting to make more sense to me. When you look at that New England offense, especially the last couple years, they've been creative. They find different ways every single week to run the football. Next week, they throw the ball to the slot. The next week, they're throwing the ball outside into the tight ends. So they've been creative. That's something that the Dallas Cowboys need to do immediately. They've been multiple as well. They can do a lot of different formations, a lot of different sets, a lot of different personnel. Again, that's something that the Dallas Cowboys need to do as well. So when you think about all these things go into the thought process. All these things may have been discussed in those meetings with Jason Garrett as far as what the team needs to do next, the type of leader that you need. The Dallas Cowboys don't need the same type of leader as a team like the Cleveland Browns. They need a guy that does, we're not talking about discipline here, we're just talking about bringing the guys together
in a better offense.
And if they are going to go first-time head coach, offensive mind from the pro ranks, Eric Bieniemy and Byron Leftwich. I don't know why Byron's name hasn't been mentioned. Jay, you can't blame the interceptions on from Jameis on Byron, but he threw for only four quarterbacks ever thrown for more yards than Jameis threw for this year. Those are two names I'd keep an eye on.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.